Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor of the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese of Vanderbilt. In our bi-monthly podcasts, we interview philosophers about their new books across a wide variety of philosophical topics and areas. Today's interview is with Helen Longinot, Clarence Irving Lewis Professor of Philosophy at Stanford University. Her new book, Studying Human Behavior, How Scientists Investigate Aggression and Sexuality, is just out from the University of Chicago Press. What explains human behavior? It is standard to consider answers from the perspective of a dichotomy between nature and nurture, with most researchers today in agreement that it is both. For Longinot, however, the both answer misses the fact that the nature-nurture divide is itself problematic. First, there is no one right way to divide nature from nurture within the scientific approaches to the study of behavior. And second, the dichotomy reinforces and reflects an undue emphasis on explanations that focus on the dispositions of individuals rather than those that look at patterns of frequency and distribution of behavior within populations. In this groundbreaking volume, Longinot looks closely at a variety of different scientific approaches to the study of human aggression and sexuality to reveal the different and incompatible ways they define the factors that explain behavior, how these different explanatory approaches are related to each other, and how the knowledge they provide is publicly disseminated. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Helen.
Hi, Carrie.
Hi. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you.
I'm very excited to talk about your new book, Studying Human Behavior, How Scientists Investigate Aggression and Sexuality. I guess before we get into the body of the book, it'd be a good idea if you could give us a little bit of background about how you came to the topic of human behavior and these particular aspects of human behavior, and then how you came to write this book in particular.
Okay. Well, I came to the topic in general because I have for a long time been looking at certain aspects of research on human behavior. In the past, it was mostly focused on sex and gender differences. And I went back to look at research on both aggression and sexuality some years after I'd finished Science and Social Knowledge, just to see what was going on. And I was very interested to find a couple of things going on. One was the vituperative character of interchanges among proponents of different approaches. Not all of them, but there were some that quite stood out, and I was curious to understand what that was about. And then I was also interested in the kind of social-political context in which these debates were being carried out. Interestingly, that had changed somewhat from the kind of context in which the work on sex and gender that I'd been looking at had been carried out. But research on sex and gender entailed research on aggression and on sexuality. So these were areas that I was kind of familiar with some of the research protocols on. So it seemed natural to follow up. In the early 90s, there was a conference at the University of Maryland. I talk about that in the first chapter that was named, I think, Genetic, I'm going to forget the name exactly, but it's something like The Genetics of Violent Behavior. And that attracted a lot of political attention. And so I was just interested in thinking about that some more. Now, so I started looking at this. I was also working on my second book, The Fate of Knowledge. And I thought, as I got more deeply into the work on behavior and became convinced that there was a pluralist account to be given of it, that I would use it as an example of an extended example of pluralism in The Fate of Knowledge. But when I got to that stage, I realized that it would be selling the issues short to treat this as a, an illustration of philosophical points rather than kind of studying this area of research as a philosopher for its own merits, mm-hmm. or merits, if you will. So that's how I came to actually write the book. And of course, as I wrote the book or was working on the book, I came to appreciate, I mean, more and more happened in the field of research, for one thing, that I had to keep track of. And it just became really very much more complicated than what I had initially envisaged. So that's how come there's a book now.
So the book itself is structured, has a, you know, in the first part, you give a very detailed, you know, critical analysis of you know, about half a dozen different approaches to studying human behavior. And then in the second part, you, you know, sort of focus on philosophical issues. You know, once you've kind of gotten the data out there, then you then you look at it. But, you know, as I thought more about the book, I was thinking about, you know, how it seemed to me to be a sort of prolonged meditation on the nature-nurture dichotomy that kind of dominates the way we think about explaining human behavior. And I saw it as a, you know, sort of a very fundamental kind of critique of the dichotomy itself. One being the idea that, you know, the division, how that division is drawn is unstable and relative to these different ways, you know, different approaches. And then the idea that, and this is a bit more complicated, but, you know, we you know, I'd like to get to it as well. The idea that the divide itself, however you draw it, kind of reflects an unjustified or undue emphasis on individual dispositions rather than sort of population-level properties. Mm-hmm. In explaining it. So there's those two aspects, you know, which you were saying, you know, the whole nature and nurture, it's not just a matter of, oh, it's both, but it's that whole way of looking at human behavior that is itself problematic. So if we started with the first issue, maybe you could say a word first about the different approaches that you examine in the first part of the book, and then, you know, how they categorize nature and nurture and the sort of incompatibilities that you see in how they divide up the problem space.
Okay. When I started, of course, I was just looking because everybody seems to look at classical quantitative behavior genetics, and sometimes with a nod to the molecular genetics, so approaches that focus on the social environment of rearing, whether that's parents, schools, or whatever. And as I kind of went more deeply into the area, I saw I had to differentiate between quantitative genetics and molecular behavior genetics. I also came to see that neurophysiological approaches were independent of genetic approaches, and that there were some interesting efforts to integrate biology and or biological and social approaches. There is developmental systems theory, which basically argues that all causal factors are on a par one with another. All causal factors interact with one another and affect the tone or causal efficacy of other factors, to put it that way. There's another integrative approach that was pioneered, I don't know that they pioneered it, but the most effective spokespersons for that have been Terry Moffitt and Ashlam Caspi, which is sometimes just a gene by environment approach, but more interestingly, a gene by environment by neurosystem approach. Those were the ones I was initially looking at. And then I also became aware of a very different way of thinking about behavior and studying behavior, which I've lumped under various different labels in the book, whether population level or ecological. But here the emphasis is not on trying to understand either individual development or variation among individuals. Rather, it's an attempt to understand behaviors as in terms of their frequencies in populations, and trying to understand not individual differences, but differences among populations. Now, there's a probably a slight, there's a there's some category differences among these, but I don't think that they're that important for understanding the kind of difference in approach that I'm trying to illuminate in analyzing the kind of different empirical investigative strategies that these approaches employ.
So I was going to say, maybe you could, if you focused on two of them, I mean, maybe quantitative behavioral genetics and a social environmental approach, or, I mean, pick any ones. I thought the example that you gave in terms of how they cut up the problem space differently was particularly clear with those two. But if you could just give an example of how they actually go about approaching the nature of the explanandum differently, and then of course the different explananda they give.
Right. Well, one of the things that was really interesting to me as I got into this initially, I had first thought that maybe what would explain the differences between, say, genetic, neurophysiological, and social environment approaches was that they characterized the phenomenon to be explained, the explanandum, differently, that somehow there might be some systematic differences in what they were measuring as behavior that would explain why they, in one case, took genetic factors, in another took social factors, in another took neurosystem factors as the important explaining factors. And it turned out that actually the behavior itself gets observed and measured in pretty much the same ways throughout these approaches, and that what differs is the causal space that they then assign the behaviors that they observe in relatively similar ways. I think I just lost the verb structure of that sentence. But so, so that the problem space is in some ways the same, namely, it's about the incidence of behaviors measured pretty much the same way. But what varies are the factors to which they assign these behaviors, or the differences in behavior, so that each approach is then trying to identify correlations between a given behavior measured in a particular way. And of course, there are various ways of trying to operationalize aggression, operationalize sexuality. That's a whole other topic that we may or may not get into. But there are fairly common operationalizations, but then those operationalizations get correlated in one approach. They get correlated with differences in heritability, say, and in another approach, they'll get correlated with certain features of the environment of rearing. In another approach, they'll get correlated with neurosystem factors. Each of these can generate correlations that survive statistical analysis, shall we say, that they rise to some level of statistical significance. But there's never anything approaching a complete explanation or a complete correlation. So they're all in some sense partial.
Conclusions you draw is that, you know, somehow these different ways of dividing up the explanatory factors are incompatible, and that this in some sense makes the different approaches, you know, behavioral genetics or social environmental or neurobiological, makes them in some sense incommensurable. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, these claims, we're all kind of familiar with them from, you know, Kuhn and you know, the incommensurability of different paradigms and so forth. So maybe you could say a word about the nature of this incompatibility and why the approaches are incommensurable on your view.
Okay. Well, it seems to me that approaches to be commensurable with one another, they have to be operating in the same causal space. That is, they have to be all measuring the same kinds of factors as potential causal factors and just coming up with different ways of assigning values to those factors through their different methods. One of the interesting features, it seems to me, of this behavioral work is that the causal spaces that they operate in are different. And I try to show this visually. It's going to be a bit of a challenge for me to try to articulate it solely verbally. But you can kind of arrange the set of factors that are taken to be relevant to variation in behavior. Mm-hmm. You can just list them, or you can arrange them in any way. And then if you take any given approach, you'll see that a given approach is only going to focus on some subset of those factors. Mm-hmm. That's the causal space that it's going to focus on. And anything else is kind of excluded from the space. They don't have the kinds of tools that are required to investigate the other space. So the approaches will succeed in getting, you know, partial correlations, but because all these other factors are playing a role, obviously they'll never get a complete picture focusing just on the factors that they have the ability to investigate. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the ways, or one of the kinds of arguments that I offer for the incommensurability of these approaches, because they're simply not measuring. They're measuring the phenomena to be explained in roughly the same way, but they're not measuring the explanatory, purported explanatory factors in the same way. And, you know, you might think, well, okay, they each investigate a different part of the causal space, but in the end, we can put it all together and get some kind of maybe additively coherent account, or maybe in the long run, some more integrated account. But if you kind of, one of the effects of these different measurement strategies focused on the causal space is that a given factor will fall into a different portion of the space, and hence its effects will be measured differently depending on the investigative approach. So if you take something like uterine factors, that is, factors that will affect the development an embryo or a fetus in the prenatal stage, factors that are independent of genetics, independent of the environment of a rearing. They can have to do with the mother's diet, features of the maternal uterine environment that have various other kinds of causes. For the behavior genetic approach, the uterine effects are going to fall into the category of environmental effects. And for the social environmental approach, those factors are going to fall, they're not going to fall into the category of environmental factor, rather they're going to fall into the category of biological or environmental. So there's the same phenomenon is going to get assigned to different categories, and so its effect is going to be measured differently depending on which approach you take. That's in the case of a factor that is just essentially left out of both accounts. There are other factors that can be incorporated into one account or the other or both accounts, but yet get, again, assigned to different categories because of features peculiar to the investigative approach. An example from the book is parental divorce, which it's a little complicated to explain because it involves talking about the way in which behavior geneticists, quantitative behavior geneticists, have had to deal with the environment, because what they're trying to do is to kind of parse the causal space into genetic or heritable factors on the one hand and environmental factors on the other. They've had to think about environment in fairly complicated ways, just because the only ways they have of separating out environment and heritable factors is through phenotypic differences and birth and rearing differences. So they will, for example, treat a parental divorce as a matter of the shared affective environment if siblings are similar, and part of the non-shared environment if siblings are different. Whereas a social environmental approach doesn't parse the environment depending on features of the phenotypic features of the individuals, rather that it investigates the environment directly. So for that approach, parental divorce is going to be a part of the shared environment, whether the siblings are the same or different. So, you know, again, what's being measured and the kind of effect it might have is going to fall into different categories. And so the correlations, the measurements that you get as the outcome of your investigations are simply not going to be commensurable. So that's what I mean by incommensurability. And I think it's really, it's both different from and similar to what Kuhn was talking about. Kuhn had a much more psychologistic way of thinking about incommensurability. Yeah. You may remember he talks about Gestalt experiments, and he's got the idea of the worldview and so forth. So this very thoroughly permeating way of interacting with the world is part of what he's thinking about in terms of incommensurability, as well as semantic incommensurability. And this measurement incommensurability, I think, you know, restricts incommensurability to measurement. Mm-hmm. So we can understand each other perfectly well, but we just don't measure in the same ways.
And as a result, it's not, one can't simply add them as you put them to get a complete picture. You know, the partial pictures overlap and crisscross in various ways.
Precisely.
Well, let me just, so, I mean, all the sciences, you know, sort of isolate certain aspects of the world, right? Chemistry, you're focusing on particular things and hold everything else constant in some way, or just hold most of everything else constant and then manipulate one or two things. And that's sort of the nature of, you know, science, at least, you know, Western science, is to reduce the number of variables, mm-hmm. you know, to a few that you could actually manage in a lab. Is the problem space, you know, in studying human behavior between these different approaches, if in all the other sciences, you know, physics, chemistry, biology, if all of these are, you know, in effect measuring, you know, taking the world, but taking it, you know, partial bits of it that are manipulable in particular ways, nobody goes from that claim to the idea that somehow physics, chemistry, biology, so forth are incompatible or incommensurable. They're partial, and maybe they're not, you know, strictly speaking, additive in some sense. But it doesn't seem to preclude the idea that there is unification there of science in some way. And so I just wonder if you could maybe clarify how the different ways of approaching, of measuring the factors of behavior, why that isn't the same sort of differences that you find, you know, between other sciences, between physics and chemistry or biology.
In a way it is, and in a way it isn't.
Okay.
I think that, let me see how I want to put this. I think that the investigation that I've done here of the sciences of behavior could well be carried on for other families of scientific approaches that are attempting to explain the same thing. Now, you know, physics and chemistry, while they're both somehow explaining features of the material world or of matter, they are looking at different aspects of the material world. I'm not sure I can fully articulate what the difference is, but you know, physics is talking about matter in motion, and chemistry is talking about, in many ways, the composition of matter. And of course, when you get to quantum chemistry and so forth, these differences start to disappear. But I think that no one wants to deny that there is a single one world that we're investigating. And here, there's, I think, one of the differences between at least some of the ways of understanding what Kuhn was saying and certainly what I and other pluralists are arguing, because Kuhn seemed to call into question the very meaningfulness of talking about one world, just because there were worlds that were perceived from within different paradigms, and there was no way of getting outside a paradigm to even determine whether there was a common world across different paradigms. The kind of pluralism I see in the sciences of behavior doesn't try to argue that there are different phenomena that are being explained, doesn't try to argue that there's that there are different worlds. It's just trying to argue that there are different ways of trying to get knowledge empirically about human behavior, each of which can give us some knowledge, but each of which is also limited and also not unifiable in a deep sense with other approaches, just because of the kinds of crisscrossing of measurement that we were talking about a few minutes ago.
Well,
maybe you can bring me back to the
Well, you mentioned you've brought up the concept of pluralism, and I did want to ask about that. Maybe you could say a word about your form of pluralism, what you call pragmatic pluralism, you've sort of motivated it. And I was just wondering if you could say a bit about what this position amounts to.
The pluralism I think I've just talked a little bit about, namely that it's a kind of epistemological pluralism. There are multiple ways of knowing the world, or even knowing some portion of the world, and what we want to know may vary depending on what uses we want to make of the knowledge that we get. And one simple way of thinking about that might be just, if we think about, the different reasons we might want to know, have some knowledge about human behavior. We may, for example, be clinicians who are interested in relieving the suffering of individuals. And we may, especially if we're thinking about psychological disorders, we may be interested in the neurostructural, what we can know at least about neurostructural bases of psychological disorders. So that's what we're going to investigate, because we think maybe if we understand something about that, we can make some progress in biological therapies, say pharmaceutical therapies. Unfortunately, those are rather prevalent these days. But may want to know which of a set of social interventions, ways to help parents in interactions with their children, are going to be more effective in reducing violence or bullying behavior in a particular school. Well, then we might want to investigate various kinds of interventions with families. So each approach can tell us which within the family of things it's investigating is more causally effective with respect to some behavior. What it's not going to be able to do is tell us, say, that a neurophysiological intervention is more effective than overall than retraining parents in communication styles. It really depends on what it is that we want to do, which approach is more successful. And so far, you and I have been talking about these approaches that are focused on individuals. But I think if we include the more ecological population level approaches, then we can see very clearly how the pragmatist dimension gets engaged, because suppose we're interested in, say, reducing levels of crime. Well, that conference in Maryland that I start my book out with was motivated by thinking that somehow understanding the genetics of criminal behavior was going to provide methods for reducing crime. Well, what's really interesting, there is that you can have the same levels of heritability of aggression in two societies, but very different frequencies of aggression in the two societies. So, it's not clear that knowing anything about the genetics of crime or of violence or of aggression is going to be at all useful in reducing levels of crime, whereas understanding population level factors that may vary along with level oppression population might actually help us to understand how populations differ, and then help us to understand what kinds of things we might or might not be able to do at the level of populations or at the level of social organization that could reduce levels of crime or aggression. So that I think is a much clearer application of the pragmatist approach.
Well, that was actually one of the other sort of big criticism I took away from the book was the fact that both among the scientists themselves, as well as, you know, the science, the popular science press, which I'd like to get to in a minute, but the fact that we, in some sense of we, are very focused on the causal, the etiology of individuals, you know, what people are, individual people are disposed to do by their genes or by their environment. And because of this focus, rather than looking at the properties of populations in terms of distribution of actual expressed behaviors, rather than merely dispositions to behave. And I was just wondering if you mm-hmm. could say a word about that, that distinction between the individual, the focus on the etiology of individuals versus explaining at the population level what difference that makes, and even speculatively why we are so focused on the individual.
There are a lot of there are differences, certainly differences it makes in how we are going to address something that we take to be worthy of addressing, let's say criminal behavior or aggression, because if we're focused on individuals and individual differences, then we are going to focus on factors that make a difference among individuals in a population. Of course, we always have to understand when we're looking at individual differences that what an approach can tell us is about individual differences in a population. You know, a population level approach is going to be informative about variations among populations. It's not going to be informative about differences among individuals. So there are very different kinds of things about which these approaches are going to be informative to the degree that they are informative. And why would we focus on individual rather than population? That was really what you were asking about. And I think that's a really complicated question, and it involves probably thinking, doing a lot of heavy thinking in social philosophy that I'm not really prepared to do. But I think that, first of all, our ordinary everyday interactions tend to be with one another as individuals, and we're interested. We experience individually the world as individuals. We interact with other individuals. We grow up in a moral culture that assigns praise or blame to individuals. There are aspects of our religious culture, political culture, and so forth that are really focused on individuals. I also think that in the United States, there's a kind of individualism that has permeated our social fabric. I mean, if you think about just the public reaction to something that President Obama said about entrepreneurs who were able to build successful businesses. I mean, you know, it just became a rallying cry. I made that. Again, forgetting that there's a whole infrastructure that's required for any individual to have any kind of success. So we forget about the infrastructure and just focus on the individual's achievement. So there's something going on in our culture that I don't fully understand. You know, you might call it maybe it's a frontier mentality or capitalism gone wild. I don't know. I have no idea, really. but it's there. That's the only thing I can say. So I mean, that's another dimension of it. And it probably that in the sciences that interacts with a kind of reductionist focus that does see successful explanation as somehow reducing phenomena to the next lower level of organization. Of course, even saying that presupposes a kind of hierarchical ordering, which may well be problematic. But,
so how?
Yeah. Thank you so much. Go ahead.
So one of the things you do at the end of the book is you describe some studies that you did in basically with media communication studies looking at popular press, which is actually sort of rare. I mean, it's how science is disseminated in the popular science press, either magazines like Scientific American or the Science Times and so forth. And a lot of that work, at least that I'm aware of, has been focused on the popular uptake of global warming research. But you actually conducted some studies with graduate students about the dissemination of information from the sciences of human behavior into the public. So it would be great if you could say a word about the actual studies that you conducted and their results.
Sure. Yes. Well, I was going a bit out on a limb in doing that because, of course, I'm trained as a philosopher and not as an empirical scientist. But I did this partly because, we, especially in philosophers who've thought about the behavioral sciences, have spoken as though there's some kind of direct relationship between what we see going on within a domain of scientific research and the public uptake of that. And of course, if we stand back a little bit, we realize, of course, that there's a vast filtering mechanism that stands between the public, as it were, and the actual research that's being done. And I thought it was important to kind of try to understand how the public gets to see what research is done. So I this took a lot of person power and research assistants recruited from both graduate students and undergraduates, I have to say, who were tasked with, I asked them, I identified a variety of different kinds of mass and quasi-mass publications and asked them to early on, get the assistance of a librarian, a research librarian, to get instances where either research on aggression or research on sexuality was being reported, and just bring me lists of all the articles in a particular publication, usually in a 10-year period. as the work progressed, it became easier and easier to do this with the advent of things like, especially like Google Scholar, for example, but also some of the indexing services that are online. Still, it was work that required the person power of students. And then I would go through and read a lot of this material just to get a sense of how it was being, how the research was being reported. And it was fascinating to me what got taken up and what didn't get taken up. Mm-hmm. And as I say in the book, the vast majority of reports of research on behavior do frame it within the nature-nurture debate. That's the kind of hook that's used to draw the reader in. So in addition to the other things we were just, I was just talking about with respect to individualism, I think there's also a way of reporting that's a function of the needs of journalism. And the journalists suppose that what we, the public, are interested in are questions like, well, am I the result of the way my parents raised me or of my genes? Something like that. And that's the hook. You can see that, for example, on the covers of popular magazines when they're going to carry a story about behavioral research or in the headlines. So the popular press was, for the most part, with just one or a few exceptions, really focused on genetic research, and then the way that genetic, as opposed to, say, social and environmental research were represented was very interesting, because genetics or neurophysiological research, biological research, was represented as the kind of research that was actually, in the end, going to give us some answers to the questions. This is where knowledge lay in the future. And research that was focused on the social environment was generally represented as somehow terminally inconclusive. It was not, even though in terms of various measures of reliability or whatever, they were comparable, the way in which they got represented was very different. So I don't know why that
happened. So what if this? I mean, so it sounds like overall the way the information, the knowledge is getting transmitted to the public is roughly in lockstep with the way scientists themselves. I mean, obviously there are different approaches that you look at, but the ones that get emphasized and even. I think you also noted in the book how the scientists themselves, between themselves, tend to look at things from the point of view of the nature-nurture divide, and that they frame it, even if they are, say, approaching it from a social environmental perspective, the framework of that dichotomy, they also hold to that framework. Is that correct? I mean, so it seems like this is a really tough thing to undermine.
It is a tough thing to undermine, and I think yes, I think they do approach it within that framework. Even researchers who will claim that, of course, it's that. Behavior that biology and environment interact will show themselves to be enmeshed in the dichotomy through the way in which they dismiss research, say the way in which researchers who are either of the DST, developmental systems persuasion, or focused on the social environment, will dismiss genetic research and vice versa. So they don't commit the error of saying it's all genetics or it's all social environment, but they treat those who are doing research in the areas that they're not doing research in as committing that mistake. So there's a kind of perverse way in which the nature-nurture dichotomy is still framing the discussion. Yes.
Well, how?
Undermine that, but and I'm glad that you saw that this book is an effort to show that the distinction is just really unstable and in a way untenable. That's great. Because I don't think I ever come out and say that. So
not explicitly, but it's sort of the whole tenor of the book. Well, how would it look? How would the research space and or the public knowledge space? How would those? How might this, you know, as a kind of a positive, you know, aspect? How might this be overcome, and what might a post nature nurture dichotomous science look like?
Well, I think that in many ways it would continue roughly the way it has. What would be different, I would hope, is interactions among the different subfields investigating behavior. One of the things that I noticed when I was looking, I mean, in addition to looking at the kind of mass or quasi-mass media representations, I also looked at the way in which representatives of different approaches took up work outside their own approach. And it was striking again here that researchers tended to cite within their own approach, but not across approach. So I think it would be really helpful to have much more cross approach interaction. This is difficult in the kind of research ethos that dominates our universities and academies. So because we're oriented to produce and produce more than we actually think. Sorry, but that's the way I feel about it. So there's a tremendous amount of reporting of research. There's much less reflection on research that might be gained by thinking about what is going on in associated areas. People have to get tenure, people have to get grants. So there's a whole economy of research that I think prevents the kind of reflection that I think would be really epistemologically useful. So I think that the research itself could continue because I think there's something valuable. Each of these approaches has something valuable to tell us depending on what it is we need to do or what it is that we want to know about. I'd like to see better reporting on the part of journalists. And maybe we just need some more social philosophy that gives us a different way of thinking about ourselves and society, ways that are not going to come from science itself necessarily, but at least ways that open us as a culture, open us up to different ways of thinking about how humans live with one another. But beyond that kind of anodyne sort of thing, I'm not sure what else to say.
Yeah, I was going to, you know, also ask about going back to the issue of the difference between looking at properties of individuals versus properties of populations. What in your view would focusing or emphasizing more the population level factors? What might that accomplish?
Well, it depends on the particular issue, but I think, as you know, since you've gotten to the end of the book, one of the things I suggest is that our individualist focus leads us to think about crime and the prevention of crime in a particular way. We focus on the individual criminal rather than on social organizational phenomena that might have a bearing on the frequency of criminal behavior in given contexts. I realize that this is a kind of stretch of reasoning, but I think we have a way of demonizing the people we end up putting in prison and conflating people who are in prison because of nonviolent violations, whether that has to do with selling drugs or immigration offenses, with violence, and treating and thinking that they are thinking that there's no reason to worry about their safety or their well-being. I mean, I think we have this horribly punitive attitude towards the individuals who end up in prison, many of whom might well not have engaged in the kind of behavior that got them in there in the first place if they had been living in different forms of social organization. So I think if it led us to think about criminal behavior in a different way, that would be a great outcome.
Okay, well, we are getting close to the end. So I just wanted to ask one sort of off the wall question in a way. At the very beginning, in the introduction, you ask what can be known empirically about human behavior, and I wasn't sure if you had intended, I don't think so, but if you intended to suggest that there was something that could not be known empirically. The idea that there are all these different approaches, that they are in some sense, you know, due to different ways of measuring the causal space, their measurement incommensurable. Is it possible that all those approaches will somehow leave something out?
That's a really good question, and you're forcing me to think about what I meant when I said that. I also think open the book with acknowledging that there are lots of different ways that we as humans have tried to understand behavior, human behavior, understand ourselves and others. We've tried to do it through art. We try to do it through philosophy. And I think that there are probably limits to what empirical investigation can reveal. Not so much limits in the empirical observable world, but there can be aspects of, say, emotional life, empirical investigation just might not be able to capture, that are better captured through literature or the visual arts or even music. So I think I'd be willing to stand by that. And maybe what that is not so much knowledge, certainly not empirical knowledge, but they're kind of an appreciation of what it is to be human that empirical investigation can't actually reach. And the other thing I think I want to say is that, you know, we think of empirical investigation as basically generating kind of measurement and measurable associations between putative causes and their effects. And I think that taking this more pluralist approach can give us a way of understanding human behavior that is very much a function of the empirical research that's done, but isn't a direct outcome of empirical research in the way that an empirical hypothesis is a direct outcome of empirical research. So I guess two ways in which there is either knowledge or understanding to be gained that's not totally empirical.
Okay, well, I guess we have time for one final question, which is where to now? I mean, do you have a follow-up project for this, or are you going off in another direction?
I'm not sure I have a follow-up project to this, although I do want to investigate ecological thinking more deeply than I have, which may turn out to be a follow-up or may be going in a completely different direction. I don't really know. So that's one thing I'm going to be doing. And I also am interested, and I have just no idea right now where this is, whether this is going to go anywhere, but I'm interested in thinking about whether the underdetermination problem, which is what kind of got me going in the first place, looks different when we're thinking about both data and hypotheses as statistical or probabilistic expressions. But I'm just starting that question, so that's what being skeptical is all about.
That's right. That's right. We get to graze all over the place. So, yeah. I guess our time is up, but it's been wonderful talking with you about your book, and I look forward to hearing about your next projects. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for these really interesting questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. You've been listening to an interview with Helen Longinot, Clarence Irving Lewis Professor of Philosophy at Stanford University, about her new book, Studying Human Behavior, How Scientists Investigate Aggression and Sexuality, just out from University of Chicago Press. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.